time on TV. Hi, Rick Santoro. Hello, Richard Santoro. I'm Ricky!
And I am the king!
A pepperoni, sausage, Canadian bacon. Listen, why don't you just get the deluxe and save time, all right? Look, I got business. Call me back in 5. There he is! There's the man whose life I want!
And now, the distinguished Secretary of Defense.
Great idea. Put a flashing light on your head while you're at it.
Well, why are you so uptight? It's fight night!
We're running security at night. I got a lot on my mind.
Watch carefully.
That seem right to you?
Kevin, that is right in so many ways.
No, I mean beautiful woman alone at a fight.
A crime is about to be committed.
Now listen to me, Mr. Secretary. I am telling you, you're the one that's going to be sorry.
You will be a witness. And the hardest thing to spot will be the truth.
I'm a homicide detective and a material witness. You can't hold 14,000 people.
Those are 14,000 eyewitnesses!
You have 1,500 cameras. 800 on the casino side, 720 on the hotel side. What are you looking for?
It was a phantom punch!
You sat down exactly when they wanted you to.
They didn't miss him with that second shot. Missed you.
I'm betting that the redhead you followed is the same person who told Tyler to throw the fight. She's one. Shooter's two. Tyler's three. The drunk who shouted the signal's four. Whoever was on the other end of that radio is five.
Five people make a conspiracy, right?
It sounds like he's conducting a very dangerous investigation.
I'm not gonna let you kill her.
Please, Rick. You're all alone on this. The house wins.
Hello and welcome to The Complete Works, an in-depth look into the career and filmography of Nicolas Cage. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me on this journey into the depths of true cagedom is my friend, co-host, and fellow cageaholic,
Mike DiCrescia.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good. I think today is going to be another amazing episode of The Complete Works.
As always.
Because we're involved.
Yeah, exactly. It wouldn't even matter whatever movie we were talking about, because anytime we're talking, it's just sparks flying, you know? Everybody's into what we're saying. That's why we have two podcasts.
Podcast gold.
Anyway, the year was 1998. Nicolas Cage had already dazzled the world with his performance in City of Angels.
That's right.
Who could forget City of Angels? And now he set his sights on a conspiracy thriller directed by an underrated auteur and the king of conspiracy thrillers, Brian De Palma. This movie was Snake Eyes, and it contains all the hallmarks of Brian De Palma's career. You got your long, continuous takes, you got your tracking shots, you got your point of view shots, you got the split screen, you name it. De Palma is best known in the mainstream for directing movies like Carrie, Scarface, The Untouchables, and Mission Impossible. So some pretty heavy hitters there. Yeah. And then film geeks know Brian De Palma pretty well from movies like Blowout, Body Double, Obsession, Carlito's Way. Most recently, 2012's Passion, which starred Rachel McAdams and Noomi Rapace. Critical consensus surrounding Brian De Palma has fluctuated a lot over the years. A lot of his movies got negative reviews when they were first released, only to discover a cult following many years later. And in fact, a documentary was just released last year called De Palma, which analyzes and celebrates the movies in the director's filmography. And that movie was directed by Noah Baumbach, as well as Jake Paltrow, Gwyneth Paltrow's brother.
The more you know.
The more you know. Thanks, Hollywood. So Snake Eyes is definitely one of those movies that was not super well received upon release.
Could see it.
Yeah, it currently holds a 40% on Rotten Tomatoes, with many critics unfavorably comparing it to Blowout, which has a similar story. In an interview, De Palma addressed one of the criticisms of the movie by saying, "There's a lot of discussion in Snake Eyes about why do we reveal who did it so soon? Well, the problem is that it isn't about who did it. It's a mystery about a relationship, two people, and how finding that out affects their relationship. Those kind of procedural movies are extremely boring."
Whoa.
Yeah, so it changes your perspective a little bit, maybe. Maybe it changed some mind. Maybe if you've seen the movie and didn't like it, but you just heard me say that, it changed your mind right there.
So you're welcome, Internet.
You're welcome, Internet. So despite the somewhat negative reception, Snake Eyes did okay at the box office when it came out. On a budget of $73 million, the movie made $103 million, And it opened at number 2 behind Saving Private Ryan.
Wow.
Yeah, 1998. The film was also nominated for 3 Blockbuster Entertainment Awards. which is an award ceremony founded by Blockbuster, which obviously no longer exists.
R.I.P.
All of which were for acting. Gary Sinise and Carla Gugino were nominated for Favorite Supporting Actor and Actress in a Suspense Film. And Nicolas Cage actually won the Blockbuster Entertainment Award for Best Actor in a Suspense Film, which I assume he plays right next to his Oscar.
I would assume so, yeah.
They are of equal value to him, I am sure.
Yeah, or sentimental value.
Or maybe he sold it when, you know, he lost all of his money or something. I don't really know. Yeah.
But he had to pay taxes on his castle.
One guy paid $20 for Nicolas Cage's Blockbuster Entertainment Award for Snake Eyes. Anyway, I will say that I adored Snake Eyes. I thought it was a blast. I think you reflect that as well. You enjoyed the movie as well.
Yeah, I had a... I had a really fun time. It's just just so silly and just over the top and ridiculous, but in like the best and most endearing ways.
Yeah, I thought
I was on board.
Yeah, I thought it was a blast. It felt like it was constantly moving. It was exciting, and a lot of that has to do with De Palma's direction, which is always like constantly moving. A lot of it also has to do with Nicolas Cage's performance, which to my mind is one of his best. I think it's one of the best we've seen so far. He's legit great in this movie.
It's pretty insane. One of my notes was that he elevates every scene to just like an insanity screaming match. And normally what happens with those kinds of things is everyone else is acting in a different movie.
Right.
So it impacts the film negatively, but everyone's acting in the same movie. Everyone's on that level.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun.
It absolutely is. So Cage plays Detective Rick Santoro, not to be confused with Rick Santorum.
Yeah, very confusing.
Which I definitely
watching this movie.
Yeah, I heard him say, like early on in the movie, he's like, "Everybody likes Rick Santoro," and I was like, "What? Like, did I hear that right?"
Political hot take from Brian De Palma. Yeah.
Years before Rick Santoro was even a thing. So Rick Santoro is a corrupt cop who gets caught up in trying to unravel this major conspiracy. Gary Sinise plays Cage's best friend, Commander Kevin Dunn. Not to be confused with character actor Kevin Dunn, known for his work on Veep and Luck, who actually also appears in this movie.
What?
Yeah, that's super odd, and I'll talk about him in just a little bit. But you know, the guy from Veep, you recognize the guy from Veep in the movie? I forget the character's name on Veep, otherwise I would say.
He's the reporter guy, though.
Yeah, he's the reporter in this movie. The role Kevin Dunn, and not the person Kevin Dunn, was actually originally offered to Will Smith. Instead of Gary Sinise, but Paramount refused to pay his asking price, which was $12 million.
Wow.
This was peak Will Smith box office time. This was after, right. This was like 2 years after Independence Day, 1 year after Men in Black. The guy was a huge star. He still is a huge star, but not quite the box office draw he once was. Carla Gugino is also in this movie in Snake Eyes as Julia Costello, and she's a great actress who I feel like I never see in much stuff, but when I do, she's always excellent.
Yes.
So that's cool. I think the last thing I saw her in was San Andreas, didn't require that much of her, but still, she was good in it. She's fine.
Yeah. She's always awesome.
Yeah. Joel Fabiani, known for his role in the British cult classic Department S, plays Defense Secretary Charles Kirkland. John Hurd, a.k.a. the dad from Home Alone, plays Gilbert Powell, a character that screenwriter David Koepp has said was based on Donald Trump. Which I can absolutely see as you watch the movie. Stan Shaw plays Lincoln Taylor, and as I mentioned before, Veep's Kevin Dunn plays reporter Lou Logan. Michael Rispoli plays Jimmy George, and Michael Rispoli might also be in Leaving Las Vegas. It's a weird thing. That movie is listed on his Wikipedia page, but it's not on his IMDb page, and it's not on Leaving Las Vegas' IMDb page. So IMDb is probably more reliable than Wikipedia in this instance, but I'm going to...
I believe they're both user-edited, so who knows?
Who does know, really? And Leaving Las Vegas had a lot of, like, really small cameo, like, actors appearing in cameo roles or something like that.
Right.
So we're going to count that as a potential Cage reunion.
Maybe.
Which would be the only one that this movie has, actually. It's been a while since we've had zero Cage reunions in this movie, in any of these movies.
Right.
Luis Guzman is in this. playing Cyrus, which is pretty cool. I can't think of him without thinking of his episode of Community, where he's walking around going, "Hello, it's me, Luis Guzman."
Yeah, I do love his whole role in Community.
Yeah.
For the 45 seconds that he's in this movie, he's awesome.
Yeah, he's always fun to see. And the David Anthony Higgins, who played Craig on Malcolm in the Middle, plays Ned Campbell, who is the guy that Carlo Gugino seduces at the hotel.
Oh, yeah.
So that was pretty cool to see. And finally, Chip Zine, who plays Mickey Alter, the guy who appears to be Lincoln Taylor's lawyer, is likely best known as the voice of Howard the Duck in the 1986 movie Howard the Duck.
Mother of God.
So that's pretty cool. Snake Eyes was directed by Brian De Palma 2 years after he released Mission Impossible, and 2 years before his next film, which I just learned you're a pretty big fan of, Mission to Mars. Also starring Gary Sinise.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I haven't seen in a very long time, but I remember really liking it when I saw it. It's one of those just silly sci-fi horror movies, yeah. So like, sure.
So there you go. And Snake Eyes was written by Brian De Palma and also David Koepp. Koepp also wrote Mission Impossible and is pretty well known for writing a ton of blockbusters, including Jurassic Park, Spider-Man, and Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. They can't all be winners. And... I say that as somebody who likes Indiana Jones, the Kingdom of Crystal Skull. He also directed the severely underrated movie Premium Rush, which everyone should check out if they haven't. Wow. Obviously, that's the movie where Joseph Gordon-Levitt is a bike messenger and he's being chased down the streets by Michael Shannon, and it's awesome.
You're ridiculous.
I've been telling you for years, Premium Rush, man.
That was the one that I missed. I missed it.
Underrated. I have it on Blu-ray. We'll watch it someday. The IMDb plot synopsis for Snake Eyes reads, a shady police detective finds himself in the middle of a murder conspiracy at an important boxing match in an Atlantic City casino. So, Mike, what were your overall thoughts on Snake Eyes? What was your takeaway coming into – what were you thinking about going into this movie? What was your takeaway coming out?
Going into this, I wasn't really sure what to expect. I've heard – you know, like we kind of said, it's a poorly received movie for the most part. I had heard bad things about it, or not to get my hopes up. But that said, like I said earlier, it was a lot of fun. It's super frantic. The camera work is incredible. De Palma, it feels a little like he's just doing it because he can. A lot of the stuff that's going on.
Yeah, I think if you're familiar with a lot of De Palma's work, which I wouldn't say I'm familiar with a lot of it, but I know enough of it to kind of get a sense of how he is as a director. This kind of feels like a greatest hits version of Brian De Palma's work, almost.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the one I'm most familiar with probably is Mission Impossible.
Sure.
Out of the other ones you listed. And this, you know, that is Brian De Palma maybe on a 5, and Snake Eyes is on 11. In terms of all the stuff that's going on.
Yeah, but the thing is, everything in Snake Eyes is at an 11. It's not just Brian De Palma.
No, absolutely. I mean, right from the very beginning, we are in like what feels like a 10 or 14 minute tracking shot.
It is. I actually checked it out. It's 15 minutes.
15 minutes, yeah. Of just insanity. Nicolas Cage is shaking down low-level criminals to get his bribe money. He's betting on the fight. He's beating people. Like, he's doing everything.
Yeah.
And it's insane. He's calling his girlfriend and calling his wife. It's just fun. And it's a lot of fun, and it feels really silly. And it kind of keeps up that energy for pretty much the whole runtime. And it's exciting, and the conspiracy and the mystery is almost Hitchcockian in some way of how Nicolas Cage is involved in it.
Yeah,
so it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Snake Eyes. I think it's an incredibly tight, exciting thriller that is unique in the way it presents the story. It's also only an hour and 40 minutes long, so it's like in and out. You know, it's like perfect length. And as I was watching it, I was thinking, oh, this is like Rashomon, the Akira Kurosawa movie. And sure enough, De Palma has actually said that Rashomon was an influence on this movie. So there you go. De Palma is a maniac with the camera in this movie. You know, within the first few seconds, I felt like, I put on my analysis hat for a second. It establishes the camera essentially as another character within the first few seconds of the movie, because when we see the reporter talking about the storm very early on, we're watching, you know, her talk, like just reporting on the storm, talking about what's going on, and she has to redo the take. And you see the cameraman is like talking from behind the camera, voicing his opinions and talking about what he wants to do and moving the camera up and down, left to right,
right.
And having her restart. And it's almost like playing on your expectations of what the camera can do almost, so that you're set for the camera to just do insane things throughout the movie.
Yeah, he reaches out and cleans the lens.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like the camera is established as a character within seconds of this movie happening, which is pretty cool. And this movie plays in your expectations very well, keeps you guessing throughout, even when it reveals, or like it reveals the conspiracy with it, like before the movie's halfway over. But it keeps you like excited and like amped. I do think the ending doesn't hit quite as well as it should. I liked the ending. I thought it was good. Apparently, the storm was originally supposed to play a much bigger role in the climax, with the tunnel getting flooded while Cage and Sinise are chasing each other down it. And because of the budget, they weren't able to end up doing that. And so I think that it suffers a little bit because you build up the storm so much throughout the movie.
Oh, yeah.
And then it's just kind of like, yeah, it just happens to be raining. Like,
yeah, it's pretty funny, though, just the way that, like, you could see that there is so much going on, like, building up, and then, like, the van just kind of drives into the wall. Like, yeah. It just kind of ends.
Yeah, but up until that point, though, the movie is just so, like, it played me so well. I was so invested in what was going on in this movie, and I was excited, and, like, it was tense, and I really, really dug it. So let's talk about Nicolas Cage. What did you think of Nicolas Cage in Snake Eyes, Mike?
Like we said, he's on 11, like, the whole way. But and like I said earlier, too, he's there. The scene that stood out to me the most with this going on is, like, you know, he's kind of acting – he's a crooked cop, and he's, you know, really super disrespectful to everyone. And, he's being, like, that kind of stereotypical crooked cop character, I guess, you know, using his power to get in where he shouldn't be. And all this stuff, but it's the scene when he confronts Tyler, the boxer, the heavyweight champ.
Lincoln Tyler, I think.
Lincoln Tyler, yeah. And he's in there in the dressing room after the fight, and he's confronting him about what his knowledge, you know, what he knows, what he saw in the camera.
Right.
And he's screaming at him, and Lincoln Tyler is screaming back at him. And yes. What I realized was, like, oh, everyone knows what movie they're making. Because a lot of times, Nick Cage, like we talk about, he'll randomly shout half of words, or like will be acting really animated and no one else will be.
Yes.
But in this, everyone is acting that way. So it makes it feel good.
Yeah. I think this is one of Nicolas Cage's best performances. You know, it's a role that allows him to let loose, to be over the top, but it's not so over the top that it's unbelievable. And like you said, the entire world around him is also over the top and, like, heightened. And so it all fits into this, like, vast conspiracy thriller kind of style movie. When I heard that this movie was about Nicolas Cage as a corrupt cop, that's basically all I knew about it going in. I thought the movie would be something entirely different than what it was. I sort of expected something like Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, you know, where Nicolas Cage plays a corrupt cop in that movie, and it's more about him being a corrupt person and, like, how, you know, things are, like, I thought the movie would be about them investigating into Nicolas Cage and him trying to hide how he was a corrupt cop and stuff like that. But instead, you know, this is a conspiracy thriller. It all takes place in essentially one location. It's a big location. Right. But it's, you know, it's a location that has a hotel and a casino and all these other different areas, but it's all in this one, like, building, which I think is cool. And instead, his corruptness is used as something for the character to overcome, which I think is really interesting. It's an arc that, faced with the task of preventing something that could have negative consequences for the world and get people killed, he rises to the occasion, despite what it will mean for him. And indeed, in the end, Cage is hailed as a hero for about a week. And then the press uncovers his corruption, and he loses everything. You know,
yeah.
He loses his wife, he loses his girlfriend, he loses his job, and he gets sent to jail for like 12 to 18 months, I believe is what he says.
Yeah, it's kind of – it is interesting because I had the same thing going into this where I was like, oh, is this going to be a Bad Lieutenant kind of thing? But it is interesting too that Gary Sinise's character explicitly tells him what's going to happen if he plays the hero.
Yes.
And then all those things happen.
Yes, it's some foreshadowing early on in the movie about what's going to happen. It's almost, it's like in This Is the End, when early on in the movie, James Franco and Seth Rogen are describing the plot of what a Pineapple Express 2 would be, and they say something like, oh, I'll sacrifice myself to save your life, and then Danny McBride will eat me. And then at the end of This Is the End, that actually happens.
Wow. I'm impressed that you managed to compare Snake Eyes exactly to This Is the End.
I'm a so man bad. Of many talents. Yes. So how do you think this role fits in with the roles that we've seen Nicolas Cage play so far, Mike?
I think it's interesting to see where, you know, we've kind of been talking about this, the arc of Cage. And how we hit peak Cage in the mid-90s, and we're still there. We're still in that level, I think.
Yeah.
But just this feels like it would have been one of those earlier films, like Deadfall. what this movie is about and what's going on in it feels like one of those early crime drama Cage movies.
Like Deadfall or Red Rock West.
Yeah, even maybe Wild at Heart to some extent, but... Yeah. it's interesting to see that this is, you know, peak box office draw Cage, and we're getting this kind of weird, crazy movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think based on his performance, I'd say the performance it's most similar to is Wild at Heart. I just feel like it has that kind of same kind of energy, with maybe a touch of Red Rock West in just the style of the movie that they're making. But this is a very different kind of movie than anything else I can think of that he's done before. And I think the performance kind of reflects that. I mean, you have let's talk about some of the scenes in this movie that stood out to us. That incredible first 15 minutes. Which are one long, unbroken take that just follows Nicolas Cage from the beginning of the fight through the assassination of the defense secretary. I think, you know, technically that's a marvel. There are apparently some hidden edits throughout, so it's not truly a 15-minute take.
Right.
But from what I understand, about 12 straight minutes of it are one take. Wow. It's just, like, stuff here and there, like, in the beginning and the end, which is insane. Like, that's still crazy. And what's incredible about the sequence is that it introduces you to everything you need to know about the movie going forward past that. You know, you meet every major character in the film. You see how Cage relates to every single character in the movie. You see Cage doing dirty cop things, like beating up Luis Guzman. You get his relationship between Cage and Gary Sinise. And Cage is giving it his all in this... In that sequence. You know, he is immediately a great presence, and you can tell he is relishing this chance to show off his acting chops without having to cut every few seconds. You know, there's just, like, the insane line readings and, like, the weird body movements and, like, the crazy stuff that we love Nicolas Cage for.
$3,000 on Tyler. This was a little sticky.
$2,900. I don't want this one.
Why?
There's blood all over it.
Well, aren't you delicate?
Tyler! Woo! Neptune High, right? Check it out right here! Go Sea Devils! You and me, Tyler! Yeah! Go, Tyler! Go, Tyler! Go, Tyler! Go! Go, Tyler! Go, Tyler! Go, Tyler! Wow! Lincoln, Tyler! Lincoln, Tyler! Lincoln! Ow! My lucky number 7.
Gee, that's a new one, mister.
Well, you are sunshine on a stormy day. You should work in the casino.
Oh, I'm gonna. I mean, yeah. I wanna. This is a sort of, you know, temporary.
Let me make a few phone calls.
Would you?
Yeah. Do you know how to deal blackjack?
No.
All right. Call me. I'm Rick. This goes straight to my special phone line.
Bye, mister. Bye.
Hello? Oh, yeah. No, hi, babe. No, I just had something stuck in my throat.
Yeah, there's that one line where he's talking to Gary Sinise, and he's talking about, like, how L.A. is a sewer, or Atlantic City is a sewer.
Atlantic City
is a sewer, and Cage is like, I was made for this sewer, and I am the king! he's shouting everything. It's just great. It is great. I mean, when did it dawn on you that this was going to be, like, a very, very long... take?
I think I realized pretty early, man, I can't remember exactly where, but it's I think it was around the time when he chases Luis Guzman down the escalator, and he, like, hops over the fence to get off the escalator, and we just follow Nicolas Cage down the rest of the escalator and around the corner, and he's, like, cackling the whole time. He's like, you took the hard way, or something, like, really. He gives bizarre readings and stuff.
Yeah.
And then I wrote a note down, because at that point we're kind of only following Nicolas Cage's character. We don't know what's going on yet. And I said, I like to think that De Palma just gave up and this was the best take they could get. Because it's just, Cage is the only one. I mean, it's frantic and kinetic and there's a lot going on. People walking in and out. We're going everywhere.
Yeah.
But Cage is the only one acting at that level so far. So at that point I was like, oh no. But then, like I said, as we move on, like, and the assassination happens and everything ratchets up, the movie catches up with him, and then we're kind of there.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I think, what did you think of Gary Sinise and Carl Gugino in this movie? Because I think Gary Sinise does a really good conspiracy thriller villain.
Yeah.
And it almost reminded me of Willem Dafoe in Spider-Man, just the kind of, like...
The
really, like, hammy kind of performance.
Yeah, he does. I thought it was funny. I couldn't help but draw that connection, obviously. I mean, he'll never not be Lieutenant Dan. But then he has the scene where he's talking about how the Secretary of Defense was started playing politician games with soldiers' lives and, like, was going off about what it means to be a soldier.
Right.
And I was just, oh, Gary Sinise.
Yeah.
Like, oh. Yes. I mean, it's still a good scene. Like, it was pretty great.
But yeah, he was very good. And also, since I just mentioned Spider-Man, I did notice a connection to Spider-Man that may be unintentional. While I was watching this movie, but during that opening sequence, obviously this movie is written by David Koepp, who also wrote Spider-Man.
Right.
And there is a scene where Cage is talking to one of the promoters who he owes money to. Right. And the guy, Cage is saying, like, oh, I'll get you this money or whatever. Well, I'll get it to you at this time. And the guy's like, no, you can't do it this time. You got to do it now or whatever. And the guy says to Cage, I missed the part where that's my problem. And
oh, no.
Which is the exact same line that the wrestling promoter says to Peter Parker in the original Spider-Man.
Yeah.
When he asked for more money. So I thought that was interesting. I noted that away.
That's pretty funny. I didn't notice that.
It's just very similar characters saying like the exact same line.
Yeah.
Very, very strange. Which does that make this move? Does that make Cage Peter Parker? Who knows? Who knows, Mike?
We'll never know.
Is this a secret Spider-Man movie?
I do really like too, with back to Carlo Cugino or Cugino. Excuse me. I do really like, we talked about, you mentioned how the camera is a character and we are constantly reminded that there's a camera, like with the point of view shots a lot. I did really like the inclusion that she loses her glasses during that 15-minute take. And then every time we get a point of view shot from her, it's out of focus. That was a really cool device.
That was perfect to show
doubt and uncertainty into her story and what she's telling Nicolas Cage later on and a lot of stuff. So I just thought that was a really clever technique.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and so you mentioned these POE kind of flashbacks. You know, we like, what's great about this opening 12-minute, 15-minute, whatever, opening sequence is that we keep coming back to that sequence through the form of these point-of-view flashbacks. And so we see it from Lincoln Tyler's perspective first, and we see it from Kevin Dunn's perspective, and then we see it from Julia's perspective, and we're watching the same event from all these different angles and hearing different stories about what happened. So it's exactly like Rashomon. You know, it could be an ordinary story, but it's telling it in such a unique and interesting way that it makes it really compelling because of that. And I loved kind of the reveal that the flashback that we were watching was happening in tandem with the opening sequence. Early on with Lincoln Tyler's flashback, you see, like, you know, he's having his own thing. He's having, like, a party in his back room, and, like, there's Luis Guzman's hanging out, and the guy who played Howard the Duck is, like, yelling at him. And then the door opens, and you see Nicolas Cage, and it's like, hey, it's Lincoln Tyler! And it's the exact same it's the exact same lines that you saw him do earlier on. But, like, you barely even register that he's doing it in the early sequence.
Right. It's just the thing he's yelling literally off camera.
Yeah, exactly. And at that point, you're like, okay, Cage is acting insane. I'm in. Like, this. Yeah. That's fine. And then you realize that, oh, he's actually yelling to this guy. And you're seeing that perspective. And that's really, really cool. And you do the exact same thing with Kevin Dunn's point of view during that whole event. And then you have Carlo Gugino, Julia's perspective as well. And like you said, it was a super nice touch that Julia's point of view is blurry whenever she doesn't have her glasses on. I loved the use of split screen during Julia's flashback also. I thought that was a really effective technique. Kind of shows how Kevin Dunn orchestrated the attack, which is awesome. and, you know, it's slowly filling out the details and giving you context for what you've seen earlier in the movie. So you see it's super cool because you see the opening of the movie and you feel like you've got it, right? Like, you feel like you saw what happened. You get what's going on. You think that the mystery is going to be, well, we want to find out who shot this guy. And we may want to find out who this person is, and we want to find out who these things are. So it gives you these questions to ask, and then it answers these questions very quickly. And then it ends up giving you just more context for what you saw in the first place. And I think that's a really interesting way to play it. And so the movie kind of slowly fills you in on what's going on. And the split screen between Julia talking to the defense secretary and Kevin getting ready for the attack, I thought was just a really effective and really tense and dramatic sequence. I thought that was very good.
Yes, I would agree. I think that was a really cool way to, like you said, it provides context for the first 15 minutes, which, like we've been mentioning, is pretty hectic and bizarre. And, like, there's just weird shit happening with him.
Yeah.
Yelling up, I am the king, like Cage being weird Cage guy. But then it all fills out and falls into place, and we figure out what, not only who, but how and why is going, what happened there.
Yep. So. Yeah, exactly. And I just love the way the camera kind of just glides and follows characters. It's just a very unique way to move the camera. Like the way it goes up in the air and glides over the hotel rooms, for example, I thought that was really cool. And you're just seeing, like, into these other rooms. Like, it shows a couple having foreplay right before sex. You're showing a bunch of teenagers having a raging party. Which I thought was just a really funny you see, like, these guys just, like, spraying beer everywhere.
Just some frat bros. It was
great. Before kind of gliding over to Julia and Ned. And I think the cross-cutting, too, between Rick and Kevin as they're both chasing after Julia in the hotel. I thought that really like ratcheted up the tension, and it had a pretty great score to boot. The music was like awesome during that sequence, and the score from this movie is by Ryuichi Sakamoto, who recently did the score for The Revenant as well. So that's pretty neat.
You know, it's really funny though, actually, about that hotel sequence or the hotel room sequence when we're gliding over, we're getting the top down view, bird's eye view of all the rooms. And I just, like, last weekend rewatched Minority Report because it was on TV. And there's a straight-up that sequence when they're – I don't know. Have you seen Minority Report recently?
Not recently, but I have seen it, yeah.
Well, there's the scene when they like, throw those little spider dudes that, like, scan people's eyes or whatever. And we're showing them crawl through an apartment complex. And we go through a floor, and it's just a top-down pan of all the apartment, rooms. And it's the exact same shot as this.
That's cool. Like, it's the DePalma cam.
Yeah, the Pomacam. Exactly.
The climax of the movie, it's good, but it feels like there should be more to it. You know, it feels like that storm, like it built up the storm so much, I felt like it was gonna have a much bigger impact. I really would have liked to see that tunnel flood like it was originally planned to, or that giant ball that's rolling around should have probably hit something.
Yeah, like that's set up like it's the first shot of the movie.
Yeah.
It's so like a Chekhov's gun. You see it, it's all the way up there.
And then it finally like rolls off and it's like swirling around the street and everything, and I guess what happens is like the cops like swerve to avoid the ball, and they like randomly kind of end up in the room that Carlo Gugino is in. So that was a little bit too neat, I guess. It felt like there definitely should have been more with that ball. I felt like it should have, like that should have crushed Gary Sinise or something. Like,
yeah, it feels a lot like a Final Destination series of events. Like at the very end, like we need to tie this movie up. Oh, let's just do all these weird things.
Here's a bunch of coincidences. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't go so far as to call it a Final Destination series of events.
Well, you know what I mean, though.
I know what you mean. Yeah, but
it's a Rube Goldbergian event that allows them to end up.
It's a Pee Wee's Playhouse Breakfast Machine event.
Exactly.
That is exactly what it is.
I did love that. I mean, I know it's also like symmetrical because the movie starts in 4-3 because we're supposed to be watching a news broadcast.
Yes.
But I did love that, like, we get trolled and the conclusion of the movie happens in 4-3.
Yes.
That was really funny.
Yeah. And the thing is, everything comes full circle. In this, like, it starts off in 4-3 and you're watching this news broadcast, and then it ends in 4-3. And then at the beginning of the movie, you know, Cage makes this big speech about how being on TV is the most important thing you can do. It's like the biggest thing for your career. It could be huge for you. And then at the very end of the movie, after he's lost everything, he just says, yeah, at least I got to be on TV.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Which I think is a really interesting way for that character to come full circle. And it's sort of, I think, De Palma's commentary on sort of American obsession with fame and with heroes and how quickly that can go awry.
Right.
And I think that was really good. Anyway, Snake Eyes, just aces all around, I think.
Yes. way to fix your gambling metaphors, Mike.
That's true. You could say it rolled a double or something. Full house.
There you go. Nailed it.
So also this movie ends with a song by Meredith Brooks called Sin City, which just repeats the word Snake Eyes over and over again, which...
Really? I didn't sit through the credits. So
okay.
I don't know.
You didn't watch the credits? Did you see it's the whole construction thing? It stays in the construction thing the entire time.
Okay, no. I saw them start to roll. I was like, oh, we got to get back to work. And then the credits started to roll.
Well, what's interesting about the credits is that... in the concrete that they're building and stuff, they're like rebuilding the building, I guess. Mm-hmm. In the concrete, you see the ring that the redheaded woman was wearing, which is meant to imply, because she gets killed, right? She's dead.
Right.
And so it's meant to imply that she's kind of like still buried within the concrete or buried within the building, I think is the idea there. So that's a really like interesting last touch for Brian De Palma as well.
Yeah, yeah, I did like that kind of sort of commentary at the very end when they're on the boardwalk and Julius tells Rick that, you know, that this is going to be a big change for Atlantic City, and he explains the history of they're just pirates and stuff and nothing's going to ever change here. And then the mob hit people are buried in the building. I think that's kind of interesting.
Exactly. So anyway, yeah, I loved Snake Eyes. I thought it was great. I was Super pleased by it. And I was excited for it because I like Brian De Palma. But I knew that this movie had a somewhat negative reputation going into it. So I was a little, you know, a little hesitant. But I ended up really embracing it. I thought it was just a blast to watch. It sounds like you had the same reaction, Mike.
Yeah, I would agree. It's fun. It's like you said, it's a tight 94 minutes or whatever it is, which is the perfect length for this kind of movie.
Absolutely.
So it's a fun, silly, exciting ride.
Absolutely. Yeah. So let's, you want to get into some Netflix reviews?
Oh, yeah, of course.
All right. Let's get into some Netflix reviews for Snake Eyes starting right now. You will note that most of them are negative. there were not a ton of positive Netflix reviews on the site, but here is a 2-star review of Snake Eyes from Netflix. I would have given this flick 3 stars, but the DVD lied about it having English subtitles for my hard of hearing ears. Therefore, it gets 2 stars.
Oh, man. Burned.
Hard to please
yeah,
this one.
Tough.
But I guess since he couldn't hear the movie. Yeah.
I mean, that's fair.
Which is surprising because everyone is screaming. You would think you would think he'd be able to hear it.
That's a good point.
Here's a 1-star review of Snake Eyes. If Francis Ford Coppola wasn't his uncle, he'd have been working in a restaurant, in the kitchen, washing dishes for the last 35 years. I feel like...
That's it?
I feel like, yeah, that's the entire review. I feel like that is the end of a sentence that he forgot to add the beginning to.
Yes.
Because he never mentions that Nicolas Cage is the one he's talking about.
Also, he's a Nicolas Cage would be perpetually stuck in his Fast Times role. That's sad.
Yes, that's very true. Here's a 4-star review of Snake Eyes. This is the best review I could find. I just caught Cage saying everybody likes Rick Santorum. You had me at Santorum. Say no more.
What? That's amazing.
Yeah. Which is right. Like it really does sound like it's such a weird coincidence that both of its main characters can be confused with real people.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he does say Santorum there.
I'm sure he says Santoro, but it sounds like Santorum. Maybe the next word begins with an M or something. But anyway, here's a 2-star review of Snake Eyes. I like this movie. Cage started out bad, but then his acting and movie character got better, and the character he played gained a little substance. I hated the 4-letter words and the cursing.
Yes. It's our old friend.
It's our old friend. I usually shut down movies when the language is bad, as it is so untasteful, and I abhor it. If the whodunit plot had not been interesting and the whys, I would have quit watching this within the first few minutes. So.
We found him.
We got
yes. I do love that every time that type of review is like, they say, if it weren't for this, I would have stopped watching this movie. But like,
yeah, you know, if you hate cursing so much, stop watching these R-rated crime thrillers. Right. Because those are the movies that keep getting these reviews.
It's amazing.
Super weird. And also Guarding Tess, which turns into a crime thriller at the last.
Yeah, in the last 25 minutes.
Yeah. Here's a 1-star review of Snake Eyes. What a waste of time. The whole plot ends where he is somehow recused near the end. Nothing makes sense with the writing of this film. Seriously, this movie is so stupid. What Adam Sandler is to comedy, Nicolas Cage is to drama. This guy can't act if his life depended on it. I wish I had a famous uncle to get me into show business. Crap, pure garbage.
Wow, hot take.
Yeah, hard review right there.
Yeah.
And then finally I got one more. Here's a 1-star review of Snake Eyes. Seems that nobody has much good to say about Nicolas Cage performing in movies, so how come he is in so many movies? Well, watch this one and you'll understand why practically nobody has much good to say about Nicolas Cage performing in movies. poor director Brian De Palma, as if his Mission Impossible was not bad enough.
What?
Nuff said, pass.
Damn.
Man, that is a...
Shots fired.
Yeah, some hot takes going on over there.
Yeah.
I do like his misleading intro, though. I think that's very funny. Watch this one and you'll understand why practically nobody has much good to say about Nicolas Cage. I thought he was going to answer why he's in so many movies. But yeah, there it is. Those are the Netflix reviews for Snake Eyes. Not a super happy crowd this time around.
No.
But you know what? They're wrong, because Snake Eyes is great.
Yeah. Yeah, go in with low expectations, and they'll be beat. And that's what happened with this movie.
All right. right, so Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdphilblog, and if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geodird79.
And you can find me on twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Thank you guys so much for listening to The Complete Works. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike's Cree Show. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. You can help support this podcast and Filmbook by taking part in our Patreon campaign. You can find our Patreon campaign page at patreon.com/filmbook. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us next week for another episode of The Complete Works, in which we will be talking about Nicolas Cage's role in Joel Schumacher's 8mm. Now, Mike, you've seen 8mm?
I have not seen 8mm. I've heard about it, though.
Okay, I have also not seen 8mm, so this will be an interesting thing. I am not a huge fan of Joel Schumacher. Many may know him as the director of Batman Forever and Batman and Robin.
The best Batman.
The best Batman movies, unequivocally, so there is that. I mean, he also directed The Lost Boys, right? That was him. And he did St. Elmo's Fires. There are some like decent movies in there, but there's a lot of crap, too. Also, The Number 27, who could forget? Or The Number 23. Is what it was. That's what it was. The prequel to The Number 27.
I mean, I've heard that it's a thriller about Nicolas Cage trying to figure out a snuff film. So, like, sure.
All right, yeah.
I mean, like, we'll it's going to be ridiculous.
Yeah, we'll see how that turns out. Plus, you can keep an eye out for Film Bookcast, where we'll either be talking XXX, The Return of Xander Cage, or Split, or maybe even both. Now, Mike, when we talked about this in the last Film Bookcast, you said XXX, which should be the priority. But now you're kind of like switching your tune here a little bit.
I am. I've heard that Split is ridiculous and is like people need to see it, and it's crazy. So I think I'm in. Like I'm interested now.
All right.
I want to see what it's all about.
Yeah, I will probably end up seeing both of them, and we'll have 2 weeks to do it. We're gonna do that review sometime the week after these movies come out. So we got some time. Maybe we can see both, but hopefully we'll get to see at least one of them. Maybe it'll be Split. Maybe it'll be XXX. But whatever it is, it'll be good because we are great.
Exactly.
We're going to begin this podcast and end it in the same way by reaffirming how great we are. Thank you guys so much for listening, and thanks for getting in the cage. You got nothing. Snake eyes, the house always wins. A drowning man.